give you between our that and our, my goal is between our discussions in class and the reading to get a good general survey. That's all you can do in a one quarter undergraduate course that covers as many centuries as we're covering. So I'm just really hitting the high spots in class. Well, let's look ahead to discussion 17. And as I said last hour, the Christological controversies continued. The end of the Eutychian controversy did not end it. There arose a view called monophysitism. I give you the Greek and the transliteration here. It means one nature. And I give you the Greek here. It came from Alexandria, the intellectual center. Monophysitism was a theory that in Jesus we are to see a divine nature with human attributes. That is, Jesus did not have two natures. You recall that now listen closely. Nicaea and Chalcedon said that Jesus, that we see two natures, each complete. You see a human nature which is fully human, a divine nature which is fully divine, the one not detracting from the other, as I would word it, and that therefore, with no attempt to explain how this could be true. It simply affirms what they understood the Bible to affirm and what I understand the Bible to affirm, that he was human, he was a man, he was tempted in all points like as we are, he was God, he could say before Abraham was, I am, and yet it does not explain how he can be. But what I consider to be the misguided attempts to work out a formula to explain this continued, and monophysitism was one of them. And as I'm saying, the theory is that we see a divine nature, one nature. Monophysite means one nature. You got that? That's what it means, one nature. One nature, but with human, and the nature was divine, but with simply human attributes. Well, this is very close to, very similar to what Cyril and Eutyches had said. If you go back and just look it up, I won't go back and trace that again, but there's much difference in that, depending on really a matter of semantics, isn't it? So it was a heresy, according to Chalcedon, although it arose after Chalcedon. That is, according to the Chalcedon formula, it would be heresy, because it said not two natures, but one nature. So that... It arose among those who couldn't accept the Chalcedonian formula, and they charged that it was Nestorianism, two distinct natures. It wasn't, but they charged that it was. And if you look at it just one way, you might see how they would have some grounds for that. But you can trace this down. I've got them summarized for you, by the way. Glance ahead, you have on page 89. I've got them all summarized for you. Isn't that handy? You're welcome. It grew in Egypt and Syria, became the religious theme for an extreme nationalism, and we see this time and time again, that people in the East, Egypt and Syria, they did not like, they considered the civilizations of Rome, and they considered the Byzantine civilization to be corrupt and barbarian, and so, as often happens, and we've talked about this before, this formula for Christ sort of became the battle cry or the flag that was waved by a group. But the issues were not purely theological. They were national. And therefore, people in the East glommed on to this view more than in the West, and it became something of an excuse. Remember I talked about how in the North and South, the Civil War, how the intimate question all of a sudden became a bigger issue in the South and the North and both sides. In other words, people don't always... It's like somebody in the church often who doesn't like somebody else in the church, and they... split the church or divide, cause trouble. But the issues are never personal. We never say there's always some theological issue. You know, we'll think of to make our prejudice respectable. And much of the success of monophysitism, not all of it, much of it, was an attempt to make a nationalistic, to make nationalism or chauvinism, as the word means, to make it respectable by giving a theological garb. Does that make sense to you? Well, that happened. I mean, you need to know that. It became a serious problem for the empire. Egypt and Syria threatened to secede. Many serious attempts were made to reconcile the Catholic Orthodox Church, to reconcile them to the Catholic Orthodox Church, but it didn't work. And monophysite churches still exist. I list the main ones. The Coptic Church of Egypt. How has the Coptic Church become into the news recently? A sect of the Coptic. Yeah, a group has sort of has come in from the outside and identified themselves with this historic church, the Coptic Christians, and saying that they have a right to, that their use of marijuana is religious. Of course, it's a fraud. The government has sort of established that they're just trying to escape the laws against controlled substances by claiming religious freedom. But there's no connection. But they, goes back to this, they try to identify themselves with one of these Coptic groups. The Church of Ethiopia is strongly Jewish in flavor. The Syrian Jacobite Church and the Armenian Gregorian Church on the border of southern Russia. Those are monophysite churches that are still in existence today. If you're interested in pursuing them, get a good encyclopedia, look them up, and you know there are some minor groups still around. We come now to monothelitism, meaning one will, thelesis in the Greek, meaning will, thelo, to will to do something. It was suggested by Bishop Honorius, I give you the years here, 625 to 638 of Rome, as a solution to the problem created by monophysitism. It didn't work, but it was an attempt to solve that problem. In the theory, we are to see two natures. Therefore, you have Chalcedonian orthodoxy, but only one will, the divine will. Well, this kind of thing had been said before, that the it's a Nestorianism, that you had, you know, the physical body, but a divine will. So it was repudiated by his successor in Rome, and by the Sixth Ecumenical Council, which has come down to us through history as the Third Council of Constantinople, 680 to 681. Well, that was later. They amended the Chalcedonian formula to affirm two wills and thereby completed, as I indicate, the Orthodox formula. And here it is. This was the final form of the Chalcedonian statement. We also preach two, that should be T-W-O, two natural wills in him. You see that? They amended Chalcedon to do away with the monothelitism. We also preach two natural wills in him and two natural operations without division, without change, without separation, without partition, without confusion. This we preach in accordance to the teachings of the Holy Fathers. And two natural wills, not contrary, God forbid, as the impious heretic assert, that is the monothelitist, but his human will following his divine and omnipotent will, not resisting it, nor striving against it, but rather subject to it. The council excommunicated Honorius, that was their statement, they excommunicated Honorius, consigned him to hell. He was dead, but in case he wasn't there already, they officially wrote his ticket to hell. And the Catholic Church has done this, by the way, sending people to hell after the fact. This presented a problem to Roman Catholic historians, because the problem was, and you still got this, but yeah. Yes, you were not listening, Gail. Yeah, 2WO, it's a misprint, mistype. I point this out, that the Roman Catholic Church got a real problem here. See, according to Roman Catholic dogma, Honorius was a pope, and when he announced for monothelitism, he was speaking ex cathedra. The problem is, his successor came along, and both his successor and the council declared him a heretic. Now, which was he? Was he the Pope holding the office of Peter, speaking divine revelation, using the keys to the kingdom? Or was he a heretic? And they just had a real problem with this. See, one of the problems you have with papal infallibility of a Pope speaking ex cathedra is, what if he's wrong? It's happened many times. This is one of the more notable times. So if you want to, and they really do some gymnastics to try to get out of this. Because he was speaking it, they say, well, you know, somehow it didn't really count. Did y'all see that? So he spoke ex cathedra, and yet the next pope declared his, and he was declared a heretic. Ex cathedra means from the chair. It means the Roman Catholic Church does not teach that everything a pope says is divine revelation. just when they go through a certain ceremony under certain circumstances, then he is speaking from the chair of Peter, what it means. Ex cathedra, from the chair of Peter, means now he may offer religious opinions. He may even offer some church doctrines which are not dogma, don't have to be obeyed, just good advice. But when he speaks ex cathedra, this is Bible. By the way, that's what we got our word cathedral. The great cathedrals in Europe were the churches where the bishops had their seats or their chairs. We find that a cathedral, and you understand what I'm saying? A cathedral is a church of a chair, that is, a bishop's church. The church of a bishop's chair or seat. Cathedral. But the word itself means seat or chair. You know that, by the way? You didn't? That's what the word cathedral comes from. This council also, now the council we're talking about, the one that restated the Chalcedon formula, is the Sixth Ecumenical Council, the Third Council of Constantinople, which is the Sixth Universal Council, and declared this Honorius a heretic. They also reaffirmed that Rome and Constantinople were equal in authority, although Rome was first in honor. The idea of Roman authority over the universal church never has been acknowledged in the East. So here they said that they admitted that Rome was first in honor, but not in authority. That's a minor point, but it's interesting to know. The controversy became academic, that is, the controversy between orthodoxy and monothelitism, became academic and also monophysitism when the Muslims swept through Egypt and Syria. This is looking ahead now. This is not in this period. Well, just beginning in this period, at the end of this period, just beginning. But one of the reasons for the comparative ease with which the Mohammedan hordes could move so quickly, I point out, was that many of the Christian communities welcomed them, referring them to the domination of Constantinople. Now, we discuss the Muslim invasion next, but the idea that the Muslims were a horrible thing for Christianity as an overall principle is not true. And a lot of them, for instance, we're going to see this, that when the Muslims came in, the Muslims often forced conversions, but didn't universally do that. They respected Christians, generally speaking, most of the time, as people of the book. And they thought it was better to have the Muslims in charge than to have Constantinople in charge, because people in Egypt and Syria didn't like the people from Asia Minor and Rome. And later on we're going to see that when the Crusaders came back into this land centuries later and began to take it back for the cross, they treated the Christians worse than they did than the Muslims did. The Crusaders, the European Crusader Christians, so-called Christians, created the Christians in the Palestine and Asia Minor, even in Egypt, Syria, they treated them worse than the Muslims had. In fact, the Christian communities look back upon the Muslim age as the golden age. Very strange, isn't it? One of the things we're going to see, one of the reasons, well, we'll discuss that later, but the point is it was no longer an issue. Monothelitism and monophysitism and orthodoxy was no longer an issue that was really troubled the church at Constantinople, that is, the church of the Byzantine Empire and the church in the West, after the Muslim invasion, because they simply came in and broke that country off and claimed it as their own. It was no longer a part of their world. You got that? The monophysite churches were then a part of the Muslim world, which was no longer the world of the Byzantine Empire. You follow me? They didn't cease to exist, it just became academic. That's like, in other words, a car doesn't give you any trouble after it's wrecked. Right? In other words, the fact that your radiator leaks doesn't make any difference when it's been totaled. Yes, question. Well, they were troubled with the Chalcedon formula, which was a refinement of the Nicene formula, that Christ has, well, which was an extension of it, not a refinement of it, that Christ has two natures, a human nature and a divine nature, both complete, yet neither detaching from the other, and unexplained. they just couldn't settle for this, so they tried to get really some of the older views sort of in new words. They tried to say, well, he had one nature, but only the monophysitism, one nature, and that was the divine nature that you have. What you when you look at Jesus, the incarnation, what you're looking at is God, who simply has some human attributes, but just one nature, just God. Therefore, his deity was everything; his humanity was nothing. Well, that sounded very much like what Eutyches had said. Remember, you drop the milk into the ocean. What do you have? So you've got really just one thing. And the monothelitism said, yes, you have two natures, but you only have one will, and it's a divine will, not a human will. So it's very close to, you can, very hard to sort them out. And they're very subtle. Well, let me give you a summary here. By the way, monothelitism survives in the Maronite Christians of Syria. The battle that's going on now in Syria between the Christians and the Muslims, it's not a religious war, it's purely political, but the Christians there, the form of Maronite Christianity, which is one of the sides in the modern controversy, they teach monothelitism. Interesting to know. You read about those in the newspaper. You see them. You know I'm talking about the war that's going on in Lebanon between the Christians and the Muslims? Well, those Christians, that Christian party, traditionally, is a monothelite church. Still around, that is. I see you're all burning with interest in that subject, but let me summarize it this way. The Christological controversies left the East badly divided. One of the reasons the Muslims took over so easily is the East was badly divided by the end of this period, that is 604. Today, there are six Christian groups in the East. These are major groups. You understand by the East now? That is, what we call the Middle East. There are the Orthodox, the Nestorian, four monophysite churches, one monothelite church, the Maronite church, the Uniate churches, which are quasi-Roman Catholic churches, and we'll see them later, and various Protestant churches. So that's just sort of a summary. Some of those we haven't talked about yet, but that's what you have still in the East today. We'll see some more of those as we continue. I give you the summary. You can look at this. If you have any questions, Inge, just look at the summary. I think you ought to be pretty well, I think you ought to know what these basic views teach. And you can see some of the, the Orthodox Jew, he's fully human, fully divine, without confusion, without separation, you might add, without explanation. Arianism, well, he's less than God and more than man. You understand that? A created being. Apollinarianism, a divine spirit in a human body, but no human will. Nestorianism, two distinct natures in a moral union as opposed to an essential union. You can review that. Eutychianism, human nature absorbed in the divine nature. Monophysitism, one divine nature with human attributes. Monothelitism, one divine will with two natures. Well, that's the summary of it. That's one of the more confusing things you'll ever study in the history of the church, trying to get those sorted out. We come now to Augustine, very important study. I give you the years, 350 to 430. He's sometimes called Augustine, especially if you live in Florida, because of St. Augustine, but I think the correct pronunciation is Augustine. Doesn't make any difference. I list here, first of all, some historical evaluations. These some various sources. I didn't bother to give you the source. This kind of thing is said about him. The greatest figure in the early church, that is, a non-apostle. Augustine was the ancient church's most distinguished son. He was great in heart, he was great in faith, love, and humility. Because of this, he was for centuries the most influential theologian of the church. I indicated the four, in the history of the church, after the apostolic age, the four most important, not necessarily, we wouldn't agree with them, but the four most important characters are Augustine, Aquinas, Calvin, and Schleiermacher. And now we meet the first of these. Schleiermacher. German, you'll meet him next quarter. Okay? We'll meet Calvin and Schleiermacher next quarter. This quarter we meet Augustine and Aquinas. So these four. And here we meet the first one. The Western Church became his bequest, one scholar wrote. He is the father of Roman Catholicism, and when his teachings had been given such an overlay of superstition that men could no longer see them, the Restoration Fathers dug back to Augustine and sparked a revolution constructed on the old foundations of Augustinian theology. You know who wrote that? I did. I thought I'd stick my, you know, stick my views in there with the rest of them. I'm serious. Reformation. Yeah. The Reformation Fathers dug back to Augustine and sparked a revolution constructed on the old foundations of Augustinian theology. Well, now, that's the only one of these I wrote. Augustine, I quoted that from another article that I've written on the subject. Augustine gave the popes their idea of the city of God. He was the father to the mystics, the founder of scholasticism, and the hero and master of the Renaissance and Reformation. You study Protestant theology, you study Roman Catholic theology, you're studying Augustine. For 1,000 years, listen to this. This is what, at least what other scholars have said. And by the way, of all these quotes, only mine was written by somebody who thinks Augustine was wrong. All the rest of them were written by scholars who think he was right. For 1,000 years, those who came after him did little more than reaffirm his teaching. And his opinions came to be identified with divine revelation. Well, quite an impressive testimony, isn't it, about Augustine? Yes. Okay. Yes, Augustine was black, by the way. He was a native Egyptian. You know that? The greatest, one of the first great theologian was a black man. He was born, by the way, I was just in St. Augustine. I was in St. Augustine this weekend for the Faith Promise Rally, and one of the folks I was staying with were telling me about the town, said that one of the real problems that the city has always had is the terrible suppression of the black people. And the black people have really been treated badly in that community, according to him. I wonder how many of those people know that their town is named after a black man. Probably most of them don't know that. But he was born in North Africa. He was remember we talked about the Donatist schism against the African party against the Italians? Well, he was of the African party. He was a native North African, as opposed to being a European. His father was a pagan. His mother was a Christian. His parents were very well-to-do, as I point out. They gave him a good education. He became a teacher of rhetoric. Rhetoric was the art of appealing, mainly of a trial lawyer, we would say, to appeal cases in court. By the way, you understand the art of rhetoric, and it's a whole, Aristotle is the father of rhetoric, some think, certainly credited with being, but rhetoric was it refers back to the times when whether you won or lost in court, and almost everything was argued before courts or assemblies, political bodies, did not depend so much on the evidence, but upon your presentation. And rhetoric was an art. He was a teacher of rhetoric, and as such became wealthy in his own right. This is sort of an introduction to Augustine. Focus in more upon his religious experience, and I do this because Augustine's theology is generally conceded to have reflected to a degree his own religious experiences. The theologies that men write tend to reflect their own experiences, that is, their existential musings. We're going to see this when we get to Martin Luther. Much of his theology reflected his own experience. Somebody said the reason Calvinism was so gloomy and so fatalistic was that Calvin had kidney stones. And if you ever had kidney stones, you would write a gloomy, you would write a sort of a gloomy, deterministic kind of theology too. That's something of a joke, but there's truth in it. And we're going to see, I think, that one of the reasons why Augustine wrote into historic Christian theology the very gloomy prospect of original sin was because of his own life, his own record. He saw himself as being totally depraved. He had a great moral struggle. His mother was after him to become a Christian. His father didn't care. Pagan. He had real problems with sex. As a teenager, for instance, he was the father of an illegitimate child, and this really bothered him. He just felt like this was a, and it was an age of a set where asceticism was being glorified in the church, so it would bother him more in that kind of setting, where all sexual urges were looked upon as being unworthy, even the legitimate ones. For 9 years, he was a Manichaean. Remember Mani? Persian dualism? And that would lead him to be suspicious of, to take a very low view of human sexuality. He left Manichaeism, became a skeptic, and lived with a concubine. This was when he had a child by her, lived with this prostitute for some time. He became a Neoplatonist. He was what you would call a reader in Neoplatonism, and it deeply affected his thought. It is generally admitted that what he did was he simply reinterpreted Christianity in this dualistic terms, Neoplatonic terms, and there's no real question about that. He met Ambrose, who was a great orator, and Augustine went to hear him, not because he went to hear Ambrose preach. Ambrose preached in Rome. And he went to hear Ambrose, not because he was interested in Christianity, but because Ambrose was a great speaker and Augustine was a rhetorician. He went to study the art of public speaking. He went to see his technique. But what happened was that he was interested in rhetoric, but he began to tune into some of Ambrose's arguments, and many of the intellectual questions that Augustine had concerning Christianity were answered by Ambrose. This is one of the great motives, by the way, to study. People have genuine, legitimate, sensitive questions that keep them from Christianity. And the answers are there, but they might as well not be there if they don't know them. They never find somebody who can answer those questions. And Ambrose did this for Augustine. In 386, he was reading a letter. He was sitting out in the garden one day, reading a letter from a friend describing the life of monks in Egypt who were living the life of moral purity. His friend wrote him and telling about these monks, and here he, Augustine, had such trouble with his sexuality. In despair, he went to the garden, and some kids were playing, and he overheard a little girl say the words, "Take up and read." Nothing to do with the Bible. A copy of the scriptures was lying there, probably his mother's, and he took it up, and it fell open to Romans 13:13 and 14. Somebody read that for us, Romans 13:13 and 14.
Let us conduct ourselves becomingly as in the day, not in reveling and drunkenness, not in debauchery or licentiousness, not in quarreling or jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make reparation for Christ's sacrifice to God.
Fine. Thank you. Now, you see, what's going on here? This is a very superstitious age. And it is a mark of superstitious people that they give great credence to omens, to coincidence. And you ever met people who just sort of, I need a message from God, or just sort of close their eyes and flop the Bible open and put their finger down at random and whatever their finger lands on, that's a divine revelation. Well, this is the kind of age that did that. And so while some scholars who agree with Augustine treat this as being providential, I treat it as being coincidental and superstitious, certainly. That is, probably a little child hears the words "take up and read," which had nothing to do with it, just part of a game they were playing, and the Bible is lying there, so he picks it up and it flops open to Romans 13, and he's been reading a letter which has caused him to muse about the problem of human sexuality, right, reading about these monks, and lo and behold, you get a verse that says, reject the sensual life and put on the Lord Jesus. Well, the combination of circumstances, you got that? The reading of the letter, the hearing of the words of the little girl, and the coincidental opening of the Bible to this text, he took this as a direct revelation from God that he should reject the sensual life, about which his conscience had been bothering him for years. He should reject this sensual life and take up the Christian life. And this is one of the reasons why Augustinianism is so anti-physical. We're going to see them that
the theology that grew out of Augustinianism, very, very anti-physical, all the way from monasticism, asceticism, celibacy, to a rejection of baptism, because it's physical, to rejection of almost everything that's visible and physical. Anyway, we'll see that as we go along. He resigned his, he took this as a divine message, was converted, resigned his job, went back to North Africa from Rome. He became he was a very great leader in the church there, eventually became the bishop of Hippo, a city in northern Africa, and here he spent the rest of his life. He's known as Augustine, or Augustine of Hippo. His house became a theological seminary, females excluded, no women allowed. He'd had enough trouble with that, and he figured that sex was the root of all evil. He lived an ascetic life, celibate, very austere, habits. He became the champion of orthodoxy against all heresies and schisms. So here we meet Augustine of Hippo. He was a prolific writer, a very good writer. His two most important works I list here, you meet these in a good class in Christian literature. The Confessions, one of the greatest of the Christian classics. It is a mystical book. You have mysticism, the transcendental abandonment of the physical, rational world. This is mysticism. You understand what mysticism means? And it's a mystic book. It's the story of his own spiritual pilgrimage. You ought to read it. You ought to be a part of your reading. It's a great book. A mystic literature is helpful. It's good. We wouldn't want to go all the way with it, but certainly it's valuable. You know, you start off with a very opening statement. He says that my soul could find no rest until it found its rest in God, in a personal experience with God. And then his second great work, The City of God, and it was written after the Vandals had moved up from northern Africa and sacked the city of Rome. To understand the City of God, and this is what I'm going to say now, is very, very, very important. And I've got it basically stated in your syllabus. Let me word it differently now in my lecture. That Augustus lived in an age when his world was tumbling down, his political world was tumbling down about his ears. It was obvious that Rome was done for, and the church was growing. And so when he said, when he talked about the city of God vis-a-vis the city of man, the city of man was not Rome. The city of man roughly was, as I understand, it's very difficult to know exactly what Augustine meant at all times. But as I understand, what he meant by the city of man was that which man had going for him. Man's societies, man's systems. These were, and what was happening, he said, was that these systems were dying, and that God had was going to replace them with his own city, or his own system, the city of God. Now, when he said the city of man, he didn't mean Rome in particular. Rome would be an example of the city of man. When he said the city of God, he did not simply mean the church. The church was included in the city of God. The city of God was was God's system that would replace the human system, which was obviously on its way out. Now, medieval theologians interpreted Augustine to mean, whether he meant it or not, interpreted Augustine to mean, by the city of God, a Christian society, and thus, whether he meant exactly that or not, Augustine became the de facto father of the concept of Christendom, where you have a Christian society where everybody is a Christian, where the church and the state are essentially one, and if we don't understand that, we will not understand medieval society. You understand that? A Christendom, where society is the city of God. Now that's very, very important. I say that because the very concept of Christendom is very foreign to us, because we have a tradition of the separation of church and state, which is the exact opposite of Christendom. Right? So it's hard for us to think about it. It's very hard for modern Americans to really conceptualize, to visualize, to get a good mental hold on the medieval world, because it was so different from anything we've ever experienced. Well, you must know that the idea of Christendom came from the city of God, although it is not agreed that that's exactly what Augustine had in mind. Keep in mind, but at least he was interpreted in that way. And I don't think he actually had that kind of thing exactly in mind, but he was used. So, we look at his theology very quickly, his doctrine of God. He accepted the Trinity, emphasized the unity and the equality of the persons, not personalities of the Godhead, and he emphasized the sovereignty of God, that is, that the only free will in the universe is the will of God. It will never be thwarted. But keep in mind, as I point out here, this reflects the Neoplatonic concept of God as perfectly unchangeable in a time-space continuum. Perfectly unchangeable in a time-space continuum. That is, God determines what shall happen, and because he cannot change, as time progresses, that which happens as time progresses is fixed. See, it was not Calvin who first said this, it was Augustine. The idea of, therefore, if God is going to be truly God, truly sovereign, he alone can have a genuinely free will. And to turn around the other way, Augustine could not accept the idea, which of course destroys, could not accept the idea that God could genuinely will for something to happen and it not happen. Therefore, whatever happened was the will of God, otherwise God would not be God. That's what he meant by the sovereignty of God. And of course, Calvin simply echoed that. It was, follow me? That is Calvinism, but it was Augustinianism before it was Calvinism. Yeah.
So between then, that even though he was Christian, he still sort of dragged along
that. Yes. There's no question about it. Even those who agree with him admit, and certainly secular scholars who are objective, or at least, you know, who don't have an axe to grind, you can study the writings of secular writers who are not writing from a theological viewpoint, and there's no question about it, this general agreement, that what you have with Augustinianism is a syncretism of Neoplatonic dualism in Christian theology, or, to put in other words, Neoplatonic dualism in Christian language. See, it was Philo, the great Platonist, Jewish Platonist, who wrote on the changelessness of God, the unchangeable God. But you understand what they meant by that? We believe that God is immutable or unchangeable, but that his will includes the reality of human free will. But they did not meet, Augustine could not accept that. You got that? He simply reasoned this way, and it's a very, you all know, this is words to you, and I regret this. In a survey, of course, we can't do more than this, but to really trace this down, you'd have to go back and really study. It's very subtle and abstract, but study what Plato meant by the unchangeable God, or especially Philo, and see exactly what they meant by unchangeable. But I just sort of summarize it to say that if God is truly God, truly sovereign, truly deity, then nothing can happen that he does not will to happen. Now, ultimately, we would say that, except that we would say his ultimate will included human free will. That God's will is done ultimately in that God will that men be free in their moral choices. But he said no. Human will is only an illusion in regards to his relationship to God. Well, not whether he has pancakes or waffles in the morning. You know, not man is free to choose that, but he's not free to choose his standing with God. You understand that? Well, you can read that over. His doctrine of man, anthropology was his greatest interest because he was more interested in himself. He was constantly, he was one of these pulse takers. He was constantly looking at himself. It's a very dangerous part of theology, by the way. This is one of the great errors, by the way, of the modern neo-charismatic movement. If you follow their theology, you become very egocentric. That is, you will get from that theology an overwhelming interest in how am I doing. And this was Augustine. He's a mystic. His concept of man revolved around three ideas, very quickly. Original righteousness, that Adam before the fall was morally perfect. Original sin, here we have it now. This is where original sin begins. It's implicit in some of the other earlier heresies, but earlier doctrines, and I say heresies, but here it's spelled out. You got that?
These ideas, Augustine was not, we're not completely new with Augustine, but he spelled them out. He codified them. He formalized them, and he did it very well. Human nature became corrupt through Adam's fall. By this he meant complete moral inability or total depravity. See, this is why this is not initially Calvinism. This is Augustine. But if you read what Calvin said Augustine was right. We've got to go back to him. Original guilt, man bears not on, this is the third, original righteousness, original sin, original guilt. Man bears not only Adam's absolutely corrupted nature, but he inherits the guilt of Adam's sin for which he must be forgiven. And then can you see, here you have a man who is, what causes him to place this particular construction on the language of Scripture and to create this kind of theology? You can see, if you have a combination of a man who's a dualist, a Manichaeist, a Neoplatonist, who sees the physical world as being the source of all evil, inherently corrupted, unworthy, and then this seems to be, now note this, he starts with that philosophical idea, and lo and behold, he finds it true in his own experience, that he has lost every battle with the flesh. You can see how this man would be impelled to understand the Scriptures as teaching that. And of course, we study in soteriology, the Scriptures do teach inability. But he just went too far. Total moral inability. You see that? And so that's what I meant by the fact that his own experiences helped to form his theology, as it often happens. Well, that's very important. His doctrine of salvation, by the way, his doctrine of salvation derives or is deduced logically from his doctrine of God and man. If God is changeless in that sense, and if man is totally disabled morally, then salvation must be wholly of God, right? Completely of God, 100%. Man's choices have nothing to do with it. Therefore, you have salvation wholly of God, or election as he meant it, irresistible grace, man's choice can neither be for nor against. The channel of grace is the sacraments, and the result, and this is the one of those major foundational ideas, Roman Catholic sacramentalism. We're going to continue to trace that. And the results of salvation are faith, justification, sanctification, and perseverance. You see, logically, here you have Augustine spelling it out for the first time. It became dogma. It became orthodoxy. That faith is the result of salvation. You baptize a baby so he can have faith. And a person is saved, regenerated before they have faith. Regeneration precedes faith. Well, you recognize that as Calvinism. Talked about that before, sure. His doctrine of the sacraments, he said sacraments were a visible sign of an invisible grace. By the way, that is the Protestant definition of baptism. You ever hear a Baptist tell you that? What's baptism? An outward sign of an inward grace. It came from Augustine. And he also spoke of them as vehicles of grace. And of course, this is Roman Catholicism. Last of all, his doctrine of the church, very important. And I apologize to you for going over this so very quickly, but all I can do in a survey course is just sort of show you the major points of what we're doing. It'd be a whole course just study Augustinian theology. It'd be a good course to have. It'd be a graduate course. So we just sort of introduce you to it here. His doctrine of the church is this. He attributed absolute authority to the church, not the Pope. Pope claimed it later, but he attributed it to the church, corporate church. He attributed to the church the sole right to interpret Scripture, not the Pope. But he didn't say exactly how the church executes this function, so the Pope said, I'll do it. By the way, you see that? The church alone can interpret Scripture, because in this dualism, you keep in mind that reason ends up below the line, and therefore, since the Bible is written in words, the real meaning does not arrive from the, that is, if the real meaning of the, if the real ultimate, quote, spiritual, end quote, meaning of the Scriptures cannot be derived from direct literary analysis, from the grammatical examination of the words, the examination of the words in terms of grammar, syntax, context, then where does it come from? Where do you get the real, transcendental, mystic meaning? Keep in mind that Augustine's a mystic. The answer is the church will give you the real meaning. They didn't say exactly how the church was going to do that. Roman Catholic Church worked out the details for him later. You got that? And by the way, the only difference between when Luther and Calvin went back to Augustine, they simply said that the Holy Spirit does it directly to everyone, doctrine of illumination, whereas the only difference is that the Roman Catholic Church, using Augustine, said, see, Augustine didn't say exactly how the church did this. The Roman Catholic Church said only through the councils, the curia, and the Pope. The Protestants said, Luther and Calvin said, no, to the church, but to every Christian. Everybody's a Pope. Everybody's illumined. But then, by the way, you see, that's quite important to know.